cutting through an overload of information to get to the heart of the story. This is The Point.
Welcome to The Point with me, Li Xin, an opinion show coming to you from Beijing. If Beijing's traffic is any barometer of China's diplomacy, these weeks are particularly busy. From the end of March till the beginning of April, China will have received 5 successive national leaders from Global South countries, including Dominica, Nauru, Sri Lanka, Nepal and Kazakhstan. The dignitaries have been warmly received by top Chinese leaders, including President Xi Jinping and Premier Li Qiang, and agreements have been reached to further deepen ties. So why such hectic activities? What do these visits have in common? And what do they mean for the wider international community? I'm pleased to be joined from Shanghai by Yin Zhi Guang, professor at the School of International Relations and Public Affairs at Fudan University, and from Maryland, the U.S., by Saurabh Gupta, senior Asia-Pacific International Relations Policy Specialist at the Institute for China-America Studies. Gentlemen, welcome to The Point. So just to give people an idea of the kind of activity that's been blocking the streets of Beijing, if I may. Now, on Saturday, March 23rd, Prime Minister of the Commonwealth of Dominica, a country in the Caribbean, Roosevelt Skerrit, arrived in China to start a 6-day official visit on the occasion of 20 years of diplomacy. Now, on Monday, he was received by Chinese President Xi Jinping, who called bilateral ties a good example of South-South cooperation. On March the 24th, President David Adiyang of the Republic of Nauru in the South Pacific arrived in Beijing for a state visit. That's 2 months after the country resumed diplomatic relations with China. President Xi Jinping had an in-depth exchange of views with President Adiyang. The two sides issued a joint statement and agreed to boost practical cooperation. The next day, Sri Lankan Prime Minister Dinesh Gunawardena started an official visit to China. He was received by his Chinese counterpart, Premier Li Qiang, during which Li encouraged more companies to invest in Sri Lanka, more Chinese companies, of course, and expressed the willingness to increase imports of quality products from Sri Lanka, while Gunawardena pledged Sri Lanka will work with China to solidly advance the Belt and Road cooperation. On the same day, Nepal's Deputy Prime Minister and Prime Minister for Foreign Affairs, Narayan Shrestha, embarked on an official visit to China. This is his first official overseas visit after taking office. Both sides are expected to cement their traditional friendship and good neighborliness. And from March the 28th to the 30th, Kazakhstan's Deputy Prime Minister and Minister of Foreign Affairs, Murat Nurtliyoyev, will pay an official visit to China and attend the first China-Kazakhstan Foreign Ministers Strategic Dialogue. So a lot is going on indeed. Professor Ng, let me go to you first. Why the lineup? Why so many Global South or developing countries seem to be coming to China all around the same time?
All right. Thank you very much for having me here. And I think this is not the first time that the Global South countries has been interested in visiting China, and it certainly won't be the last. And I think it demonstrates a continuing devotion of China towards South-South collaboration, and it demonstrates to the entire world that how important China sees the connection with the Global South country and addressing the common problem that the Global South countries are facing, which is development and having a true multipolar world and having the possibility to choose from different ways of enhancing their own capabilities. Mm-hmm.
Professor Gupta, we have you from India. There's nothing about why we choose an Indian guest, originally India. I have you on the show because of your objective opinion, as always, and your very insightful comment. So how do you look at the fact that these countries seem to be, you know, coincidentally arriving here? Is it because really this is, you know, a busy springtime, a good time to visit, and people don't want to wait longer? Or is there some kind of trend really demonstrated here?
Well, I wouldn't call it a trend per se. This is a continuation of China's outreach to the Global South and the Global South's outreach to China. You know, President Xi has talked about pathways to modernization, and he's talked of it fairly often, and he's talked of alternative pathways to modernization. There is not just one pathway to modernization. And China has blazed a trail in terms of its own pathway to modernization. And all these countries are developing countries looking forward to become modern, advanced economies. And they would like to blaze their own little trails too. And this is a chance to learn from China and also find ways to cooperate with China. So I think China has made a great emphasis on Global South cooperation. You know, but just within the last 3 years, we've had this Global Development Initiative, Global Security Initiative, Global Civilization Initiative, all of which are located in global multilateralism, UN-centered global multilateralism. This is something which appeals to countries of the Global South and should appeal to, frankly, all countries in the UN system. But it's cherished and valued by these countries. And this is a good time to come to China now that the big political meeting or the two sessions meeting is over. And now it's time to, again, move forward with diplomacy. And I think it's going to be a lot of active diplomacy with the Global South, but also with important countries in the Global North.
Professor Ng, do you agree? And also, what concrete agreements have been achieved between the two sides among the different countries? Do you see a commonality there?
I absolutely agree. I think this is a great time, and it shows China's determination in working together with the Global South countries and the world in large. And in terms of concrete achievements, and I think the emphasis on utilizing the existing framework, such as Belt and Road, and enhancing it, and continuing to press on the importance of high quality open door policy and the enhancement of our national capacity across the world, uplifting properties, all sorts of things, focusing on infrastructures, all sorts of things are considered as concrete.
So I also noticed, yes, the word high quality Belt and Road cooperation being mentioned repeatedly among these meetings. Another thing that's also very interesting is, as reflected in the joint statement between China and Nauru, that the two sides agreed that all countries, regardless of size, strengths, and wealth, are equals. And also, I see that message being reiterated here and there between among the meetings between the leaders of China and the visiting countries. Gupta, this is a principle. Of course, some people would say it's very easy to say, but you know what you're doing, you're probably not doing it. But why is it important for China to stress this point and repeatedly?
I think it's a very important point to stress for a couple of reasons. One is we have the UN-centered multilateralism, but we are unfortunately also in parallel, we are seeing countries devolving or at least wanting to devolve into block-like formations. This goes against the very concept of global multilateralism. And therefore, I think it's important at this point of time to speak to the fact that whether you're small or big, your primary affiliation should be with the global multilateral system. We've also had unfortunate statements come out from time to time. You know, Secretary Blinken, it wasn't too long back, I think sometime earlier this year, he talked about either you're at the table or you're on the menu. And that doesn't sound right. It is not right. And it just as a matter of principle, it is not the way global geopolitics should be approached. Even if one tends to think that we're breaking down into great power rivalry, which I don't think is necessarily needed or should be the case, because I think the major countries have enough reasons to cooperate with each other. But I think it is some of these unfortunate winds which are floating in the atmosphere which need to be tamped down. And I think this is a great example of cooperation. When did the Prime Minister of Dominica or Nauru get to the White House last? Is it 1980s? It might be something like that. And this is, I think, just to show to the international system that we are at bottom, we are all one, we are equal, and each one has one vote at the United Nations General Assembly, and that we need to approach global politics from that standpoint, which is again a message in the global security initiative and the global civilization initiative too.
Yeah, for anybody who may be wondering whether China is what China position is concerning the current international order, the managing director of International Monetary Fund or IMF, Kristalina Georgieva, and president of the World Bank Group RJ Bonga have been received by Chinese Premier while they're in China to participate in a very high level. So in case there is doubt that China is, you know, shifting away its commitment from the current international structure, we also have, of course, the efforts by China to open up and to strengthen or stabilize relations with other Western countries. Professor In, what is China trying to balance here in terms of diplomacy, being a very important member of the Global South, but also trying to stabilize its relationship with the Global North? What is China's strategy here, according to you?
Well, I think a true multilateralism emphasized on the equality of all, not necessarily, but under a certain hegemon. So what China is doing is to demonopolizing the global political structure and financial structure that supports it by first recognizing the existing importance of the existing structure, but at the same time by emphasizing the importance of introducing more choices for the world, choices of political and international infrastructure and economic structure that truly brings forward the equality among particularly the small and weak countries, which are formally not recognized, unfortunately, in the hegemonic world order. And this is to go back to what the UN Charter was suggesting, the equality, regardless of small, big or small, the equality of countries.
Thank you very much. We have to leave it there. Lots to unpack, but I hope we have already shed light on some of the key messages. Professor Ying Zhiguang and Saurabh Gupta, thank you for your insights. Right. We'll take a short break, and when we come back in the serene Mount Uyi in southern China, I spoke to an American journalist who explored the differences between Chinese and Western political wisdoms and systems at a time when the West is experiencing some backsliding. Stay with us.
Making room for all opinions and seeing events from more than one side. This is The Point.
What does the West get wrong about China? What are the differences between Chinese and Western political systems in the tranquil landscapes of Uyi Mountain in southern China's Fujian province? I talked to Benjamin Norton, editor-in-chief of Geopolitical Economy Report. He warned that many Western societies are experiencing democratic backsliding. What makes him believe so? Let's hear what he has to say. Benjamin, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And it's good to see you in person.
Yeah, it's a pleasure being here in this beautiful park.
Yeah, I've interviewed you a couple of times. You have also have very strong opinions against imperialism. That's an exercise that you think is the United States. But I always wondered, how come you developed these ideas? What made you the person you are today?
Well, a lot of things. I mean, I'm in my 30s and I went to college during the financial crisis in the United States. And for my generation, many people thought that there was basically no hope in the future. We were told that jobs may not exist. There was also the issue of student debt. We grew up during the Great Recession, right? And furthermore, in the United States, there are a lot of problems and we could see them getting worse over time. More poverty, more and more homelessness. So, you know, we've heard this idea for many years that in the United States, each generation lives better than the previous generation. Well, that's actually not true for my generation. In fact, the standard of living for our parents was higher than the standard of living for our generation. And in fact, not only has the standard of living dropped, but even the life expectancy has dropped. So among my generation, people live for fewer years they live less than the older generation. So we're in a moment of political and economic crisis in the U.S. And meanwhile, you can look at other countries, in particular China, which is the exact opposite. Poverty is falling, economic development is incredible, and the way that China has been able to do this is through a socialist system, a unique system of socialism with Chinese characteristics.
What is your sense of the kind of orderliness or disorderliness that we're seeing in this world? I feel, because we do this kind of discussion all the time, I feel sometimes there is a strong sense of helplessness, that you know something is wrong, you know there something has to be done in a certain way, but it's going to the opposite direction. Do you think we're entering a period of time of great disorientation? And, you know, is there what could be the danger if that is the case?
Well, unfortunately, I do think we're entering a very turbulent time. Many of these societies in the West are becoming less and less democratic, and it's precisely a product of the deregulation of the financial sector and the incredible power of capital. Now, I think it's, people have pointed out that, yes, in China, there are wealthy people, but wealthy people do not control the government, whereas in the West, wealthy people do control the government. We have a small handful of oligarchs, billionaires, who are getting richer and richer and more powerful. And in countries in particular like the United States, but also in some European countries, they have incredible power over the political system. So the Supreme Court in the United States, through Citizens United, was a ruling that said that there is no limit on campaign contributions from big companies, from banks, from wealthy interests. What that means is that essentially, if you're running for office as a politician, you have to do what these large corporations, these large financial interests want. It's the opposite of the Chinese system. And the Chinese system, the big companies, they do exist, but they do not control the government. In fact, they're regulated by the government. Whereas in the US, they control the government.
The
they essentially, they lobby. Lobbying is legal, whereas in many countries, this would be illegal. So what we have is this crisis where people don't have influence on government policy. In fact, there are scholars in the United States, including at Princeton and Northwestern University, who did a study. And the study quantitatively showed that average people have zero influence on policymaking. Instead, it's lobbying groups and big money groups.
Yeah.
So that's why people feel so angry on
But they can vote?
Making. Voting does not mean a democracy. I mean, you can have
That's what,
elections,
yeah, as a devil's advocate.
Yeah, I mean, a democracy means rule by the people. But just because you have elections doesn't mean that the politicians who win the elections represent the people. And we can look at many different policies and see that there are policies like universal health care that are very popular, or free higher education. These are very popular policies, but they're not implemented because they're not profitable, because the politicians who win the elections, despite the fact that people vote for them, they don't represent the popular will of the people. And that's why when China talks about whole process people's democracy, it actually can be a true form of democracy, because the reality is that the policies implemented by the Chinese government are more reflective of the interests of the Chinese people than the policies implemented by the U.S. government. So it doesn't matter if you have elections if the politicians who are elected don't actually represent the people. And we've seen this very clearly in the United States. And that's why we're seeing this rise of these very far-right populist movements. And it's because there is a lack of alternatives.
The thing is, look, Donald Trump was in office. And 4 years later, he still has so much popular support, despite the kind of performances that, you know, many people judge to be disastrous. Why are people not making the kind of realizations that they need to be? They're not coming to terms with.
Everything that people learn about what's going on is mediated through the media, right? And the media in the U.S. in particular is very partisan. It's very biased. You have very conservative media like Fox News. You have media that's affiliated with the Democratic Party like MSNBC. Everything is filtered through these lenses. And what we see is that life for many people is getting worse, for average working people. Of course, if you're wealthy, you can live very well in the U.S. But for average working people, their wages have been stagnant since the 1970s. We see that you don't you probably won't have Social Security. My generation is being told there will be no retirement funding, no pensions. Healthcare is extremely expensive. Education is prohibitively expensive. So you have all of these problems. Meanwhile, you have more racism, violence, instability. So people can see that their lives are getting worse. And yet they have two choices in the political system. You have the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. The Democrats are incapable of providing alternatives because they ostensibly say they want to provide better policies for working people, but they're also beholden to the big money interests. So they have this contradictory policy where they say they want to give us more education and healthcare, but they don't do it. And then you have Republicans, and what is their response? They scapegoat immigrants. They blame feminism. They blame
China
for everything. They're now, you know, we have this drug issue. They blame China, which has nothing to do with it. In fact, the drug issue in the U.S. was caused by big pharmaceutical corporations, including Purdue Pharma, which faced dozens of lawsuits for basically giving money to doctors to encourage them to overprescribe medicine like OxyContin, which got people addicted,
yeah.
And then they get addicted to other
forms. It's the consumption that's the problem.
And it's the system, absolutely. And so people are looking for answers, and people like Donald Trump give them easy answers. They're not the correct answers, but easy answers. The problem is China. The problem is immigration.
Mm.
And if you don't have answers from the Democratic Party that convince people, they will look for these kind of populist answers. And it's a very dangerous moment.
Do they not count the money in their pocket when they turn to the Republicans? I mean, if Trump did such a bad job during his time with the economy, do people not say, oh, you know, my wallet got tighter, so I'm not going to vote for Trump? But it seems that they do.
Well, you should keep in mind a few things. First of all, in U.S. elections, in presidential elections, only about half of adults vote. This is a very important fact. It's often forgotten. In midterm elections, every 2 years, only around 20% of adults in the U.S. vote. Many people do not feel that the political system represents them. There is a lot of apathy, and it makes sense. I mean, a lot of people say, why would I vote? Because nothing will change. It's very common to hear that. So people feel disenfranchised. Whereas in China, we're told that China is supposedly undemocratic, but in reality, the Chinese system is significantly more representative and more efficient. You don't have to spend all of this time with this interminable battle where you have these laws that are passed that are thousands of pages long. And why is that? You look at these laws passed in the U.S. because every politician tries to throw in their own what they call pork barrel politics. So we have something in our state that we want to throw into this law. So what happens is these laws get passed that are 4,000 pages long. No one even knows what's in these laws, because in order to get the law passed, the Republicans and Democrats have to fight to say, we're going to put this in and put this in.
Yeah.
But who's left out of it? The people are left out of it. These laws are not passed for the people. These laws are passed for special interest groups, for a bank, for a military contractor, for some certain company.
Yeah.
And again, so the reality is that we talk about the economy doing well. Well, okay, maybe GDP growth is high in the U.S., but that's because, one, federal debt is last year it was 6.2% of GDP, the deficit. So federal debt is skyrocketing. Furthermore, it's also because, yes, GDP is growing in particular in the financial sector, in the military sector, making weapons and ammunition. But if you look at the actual good-paying jobs that people want, industrial jobs, teachers' salaries, those are stagnant or they're declining.
So what kind of inspiration are you looking for by being in China, especially by coming to the UE Forum? Do you think you have found something that may give answers to some of the dilemmas that you talked about?
Yeah, I think China has a model for the entire world. Its economic model is absolutely incredible. The way that China has been able to develop through its unique system of a socialist market economy, dealing with some of the issues that I've been speaking about, where capital does not control the government. It's the opposite. There are private companies, there are wealthy people in China, and they're allowed to operate, but they don't control the government. Now, furthermore, I think China is making huge progress in new technologies that are very important for the green revolution, for transitioning away from fossil fuels. Climate change is an issue that affects everyone. It doesn't respect borders. And climate change is getting worse every single year. And China is the world leader in three of the most important cutting-edge technologies, the new three technologies of batteries, of solar panels and wind turbines, and also electric vehicles. And unfortunately, the response of the U.S. is saying that we don't want electric vehicles from China. We don't want to collaborate
with China.
National
security.
They say, yeah, national security is always the excuse they use to justify protectionism and trade war policies. But instead of engaging in this aggressive kind of trade war against China, the U.S. should be collaborating, and we should be working together in order to transition away from fossil fuels, to transition toward green, renewable energy.
To link it back to the traditional Chinese culture, I'm sure you have gotten a first-hand view of it. You know, it's a very vast subject, I know, but from bits and pieces that you have come across, that you have experienced, what made it possible for China to do the things that you just said?
Well, China is so unique because it has 5,000 years of history. It's very different from the U.S., which only has a little over 200 years of history. And unfortunately, in those 200 years, the U.S. has, for almost the entire history, been at war, whereas China, in recent history, has not been at war. It's been at peace, and China is one of the few countries that has been able to develop peacefully. And I think China is really remarkable in the way that it's been able to integrate with the two integrations, Marxism, socialism, with its unique history, its unique culture, and China has shown that you can integrate them. They're not contradictory. And I think one of the unique ways that China has done that is it's shown that throughout the history of Chinese civilization, the people have always been fighting for their rights, fighting for freedom against oppressors, against the old dynasties. And
the right to revolution.
Absolutely, the right to rebel. And I think if you go back throughout Chinese history for thousands of years, you can see all of these rebellions, and they eventually lead to the 1949 revolution, which has its historical origins in these past rebellions, the Boxer rebellions and many other. So I think China is unique in that sense, and I think other countries can learn from that.
Thank you so much. Very interesting, very thought-provoking discussion. A lot to unpack, but time is very limited. Editor-in-Chief of Geopolitical Economy Report, Benjamin Norton. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
With that, we come to the end of this edition of The Point with me, Liu Xin. As always, you can follow me on Facebook and Twitter using the handle Liu Xin in Beijing. On behalf of the whole team, thank you for joining us. You've got The Point.